Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We begin today's show with Robert McChesney, a longtime author, activist, and professor focusing on the media, politics, and what it will take to improve the current state of journalism. What can we do to ensure that the media actually serves the public good? Robert McChesney is professor of communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, co-founder of the media reform organization Free Press, and author and editor of many books, including Will the Last Reporter Please Turn Out the Lights? The Collapse of Journalism and What Can Be Done to Fix It? Well, one solution he lays out would establish a budget of $100 per person in the U.S. to support local nonprofit journalism and then let people vote to decide which media outlet gets the money. Hi, Robert. Welcome back to the show. Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. We're going to talk about solutions before we let you go. But first, I want to ask you how you're thinking about where we are. Because when you look at today's media landscape and what has changed over the past few decades, I mean, the fact is it's pretty dire. What really keeps us up right now is that so many people are on the dark corners of the web. That is where they get all of their information. And you have pointed out recently that while you used to talk about the effects of media monopolies, now we really need to talk about the fact that the advertising model is dead. So there's so many things to discuss. And I just wonder, given where we are right now, how are you thinking about all of these issues?
Well, I think we, as you accurately put it, it's a dire situation. In fact, that might be a very weak way to present it because of the magnitude of the crisis we face. To give some sense of what's happened to the journalism model, in the middle of the 20th century, and for much of American history, about 1% of GDP was dedicated to daily local journalism, daily newspapers. And that figure now is under 0.1%. And people will say, well, gee whiz, daily newspapers don't matter anymore on the internet. But it's still, ironically, much of what local journalism has done is done by journalists paid for ultimately by a local newspaper. The internet has not come up with any way to fund local journalism at all. And to just add on to that, what we've seen in the United States for the first time in our history over the last 10 or 15 years has been the disappearance of local journalism in large parts of the country. There are communities, there are counties that have no competing newsrooms in many places that have no reporters whatsoever covering them. So people who live in these communities really have no information about public life that they can use or civic life to participate as citizens in the governance of their community.
To your point, according to usnewsdeserts.com, this is a website run by the Knight Foundation, 200 counties across the country do not have a local paper, and half of all counties, 1,540, have only one newspaper, and it's usually a weekly.
Yeah, and what we have, in fact, is that in large parts of the country, people really have no access to information. And let's not exaggerate how great the information is in the other few thousand counties in America. Anywhere you go, and there's no one, and this is true in the Bay Area as well, if you were here 30 or 40 years ago and you picked up a daily newspaper, it actually took time to read it. There was actually a lot of stuff in it. Now I can pick my morning newspaper, and by the time I get from my front door to my kitchen table, I've read all the original journalism in it that matters. It's basically dead. Now, people will say again, well, you're just talking about newspapers. And they're right. The technology of newsprint, of paper, is irrelevant. What we're talking about is people who are accountable, who are paid to cover their communities, to cover the news, to bring information to citizens. It ideally should be done in a competitive environment where you have several different people telling, covering the news so they can keep each other honest and there are choices for readers where to go and they can compare and contrast. But very few Americans even have that. It's not the local level is where it's worse, but it's also true at the national level. And this is something someone over the age of 40 will remember well. You know, in the 1960s, 70s, and into the 80s even, well into the 80s, there were probably, 20 major newsrooms in Washington, D.C. that were covering politics in that city. Most of the great newspapers, the LA Times, Chicago Tribune, Baltimore Sun, they all covered Washington, not just the Post in Washington and the New York Times. Now it's basically not in the New York Times. New York Times is to Washington, D.C., with the Washington Post, but Pravda and Izvestia were to the Soviet Union. We really only have a small number of people covering the national politics, too. And that is, and I think that for those who study journalism, the crisis here, when you have so few news media and reporters, is that they miss a lot of stories, even if they're well-intended. Even if they're the best journalists in the world, they simply can't cover a lot of the most important stories that are slipping right on by. Stories about government corruption, malfeasance, crises that go unreported and then unaddressed as a result. And just the routine stuff. When's the next election? How is the pandemic response going? This sort of information is much harder to find for people than it used to be from a reliable local source.
During or between 2008 and 2019, newspaper staffs shrunk by a whopping 51%, according to the Pew Research Center. And during COVID, 60 newsrooms shut down completely. We listened to an interview you did with Paul Jay, who runs the analysis.news, and you said something has changed fundamentally, and that is journalism is no longer profitable. No one is investing in journalism if they're out to make money. It has lost all of its commercial value. Can you talk about the importance of this?
Yeah, in the history of journalism in America, the first 100 years or so, it wasn't an especially profitable enterprise. It was great fortunes weren't made, some were, but for the most part, it was a political undertaking. In the 20th century, that really changed. Advertising came to be the primary means of support. Most newspaper towns became monopoly towns or duopoly towns, and they became incredibly profitable. So when I grew up, well into adulthood, the idea was that journalism was a place you could really get rich if you had a series of newspapers, you had it made. Well, all of that has changed fundamentally, a 180-degree change from the early 1990s to today. And the reason for that is that advertisers no longer need to support journalism at the local level. They no longer have to provide 50 to 80% of the revenues to pay for journalism anywhere. They have alternative sources to use their funds to reach their commercial ends. And as newspapers then begin a downward spiral with less resources, they become even less attractive to both readers and advertisers. And we're near the end of there. It's just going right down the drain. And investors, capitalists, people are trying to make money. He used to love newspapers. Warren Buffett said it was the best investment he ever made was buying the Buffalo News. He said he was guaranteed money no matter what you do. And that was true for a long time. But investors have wised up. They've realized now it's a terrible investment. You know, when Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post, was it 10 or 15 years ago? I can't remember the exact date. He probably bought it for 1/10 of what it would cost him a decade earlier, or 1/20. He got it for pennies on the dollar. Because he didn't buy it as an investment to make money. He bought it purely for political reasons that he knew would give him a lot of leverage over the country's politics, not that it was a smart investment to make more profit. And that's the way it is for all investors now. These properties can't be sold to anyone who's actually out to make money. When newspapers are sold today, they basically are sold to hedge funds who strip them for parts and you take the real estate they own and the assets and turn them around and sell them off. No one's buying newsrooms, newspapers, news properties, as they call them, and then expanding the workforce and saying, we're going to provide a great product because then we'll make a lot of money. Because they won't. There won't be funds to pay for it. Everything's going in the exact opposite direction.
Hmm. Yeah, Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post for $250 million.
Yeah, it was probably worth $5 billion in the early 90s or mid-90s.
Wow. And part of the problem you point out is that advertising provided about 60 to 100% of revenues for newspapers.
That's right. And that's the whole key to the story there. Once advertisers realized that they could go online and find far more effective, cost-effective ways to sell their products, combined with the collapse of newspapers as a mass medium at the local levels, the quality of the product disintegrated. When those two things come together, that pretty much wipes out the whole commercial model of journalism, which is predicated on advertising. It's not predicated on final sales to the consumer. That was just a minority of the revenues that would come into a newspaper. And journalism has never, anywhere in the United States, ever survived purely supported by readers, I mean, popular journalism, that is, mass journalism, daily journalism. Throughout its history, it was supported by advertising in the 20th century. And before that, in the first 100 years of American history, journalism was supported to no small extent by huge government subsidies. Basically, the post office distributed all the newspapers for almost for free, which took an enormous cost away, made it a lot easier to publish newspapers successfully.
And as you've pointed out, when you look at every social movement that has happened in this country, people in these movements had newspapers, media, in some cases were participants in social movements. And there were so many diverse views. Media was just foundational around these movements.
You know, even before we get to the great movements you're talking about, you go right back to the founding of the country. And, you know, there's perfect grounds for criticizing a lot of the people who framed this country, and grounds for praise, too. But the one thing that they all agreed on, I mean, from Hamilton and Washington to Franklin, Jefferson, Tom Paine, was this central need to have a well-funded press system, because without that, the whole republic system would collapse. You needed to have an informed citizenry, and a citizenry that had an ability to express their own thoughts as well as receive the thoughts from on high. And so it was central to the vision of this country was the ability to have a press system, which is why they instituted the post office primarily to distribute newspapers virtually for free. I mean, at 1/20th the cost of a letter by comparison at the time, because they understood newspapers just needed to be made accessible to people or else the governing system simply couldn't survive. Well, that holds true today. That's our situation today. And newspapers were central to politics, and journalism was central to politics. And this gets to your question. When the abolitionist movement came along, the whole movement was a movement of editors like Frederick Douglass. Those were the people who were the organizers of coordinating the movement. The suffragette movement, same thing. Editors led it. They had newspapers. The labor movement built around newspapers. All these, the newspaper is the central rallying cry for all great social movements, and has been through to the present day. And now we've lost that. We have the internet, but what we don't have are the same stature institutionally. We don't have the same resources that existed before. And that's a real crisis for us.
What happens to a society when, and I know a lot of people who do this, so no offense, when they only read the Washington Post and watch the cable shows and don't know much about what's happening in their own backyard? A lot of people don't know who their state senator is, their supervisor, for example. What happens to a society when that happens?
Well, we're finding out because we're sort of like the first time we've been in this boat, really. It is an astonishing moment we're in that, you know, basically probably a lot of your listeners plug into, you know, different shows on television and radio. But, you know, it's a fairly limited palette that you're getting. Let's say you're most of the people in the neighborhood I live in watch MSNBC or CNN on TV, maybe get the New York Times. And that's a lot of their news consumption, plus what they get online. And they're getting the amount of working journalists who work for MSNBC and CNN is very small. And they're only covering a very small number of stories, which they constantly go over. And much of their coverage is gossip, just gossip. Each hour, a new host gossiping about the two or three talking points of the day, the stories of the day. Huge amounts of the government that are so essential are completely lost as a result. And also the local coverage, as you said. I mean, I think that's the greatest crisis, and the one that's least talked about is the complete lack of local journalism and the detachment people have from their communities as a result.
We talked about newspapers. Let's talk a bit about radio. First, let's talk about commercial radio. I remember when I was covering Standing Rock, driving from Standing Rock to Bismarck in North Dakota. It's about a 2-hour drive. And the only stations on the radio were right wing. I heard Rush Limbaugh, Christian radio, and music. And that was it.
Yeah, that took place in the 1990s, basically, that radio was converted into a right wing factory. Politically, for the most part, with only a handful of exceptions all across the country, even in communities and cities that were not especially right wing, the right came to dominate that medium, except for the music offerings and NPR and community stations. And that changed the culture of the country. That created an opening for providing a particular worldview And going somewhere where you'll always get that worldview and that take on how to understand anything that takes place in the world. So that was a decisive moment in our history. Radio has expanded. That was sort of the, that's where the foot was put in the water. But radio has now expanded, of course, onto television by the end of the 1990s. And now today, all over the internet and the dark web and the non-dark web.
Do you listen much to NPR?
I do, not a great deal, but when I'm in my car, I do. I don't listen to it at home as a rule. I've got other things I listen to.
What do you think of it overall, their news programs?
NPR, from my experience, has been, is a, it's sort of like the New York Times in the sense that it's the best of conventional journalism, but it's very much conventional journalism. It's, you know, when you look at something like foreign policy, the range of debates going to be whatever the debate is between Republicans and Democrats at the top of the party, which means there's not a whole lot of debate because they generally agree on the basics. And so dissident views that oftentimes are found out to be the truth and that our media system ought to be examining and promoting so we can have better policies are shunted to the side or dismissed or ignored. So I think they're weak the same way all conventional journalism, even the best, is. But the good part of them is they tend to be a lot less salacious than much commercial journalism, what remains of it.
Robert McChesney is professor of communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, co-founder of the media reform organization Free Press, and author and editor of many books. We're going to talk about one of the solutions that he lays out for publicly funded media. If you have any questions or comments for Robert about the state of the media, how we got here, and what can we do to ensure that there's a thriving independent media at the local level, especially, gosh, in places where people are just going into the dark corners of the web for their information. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. I know you've received this question about this whole notion of objectivity for so many years. And I just wonder what your thoughts about that are today. You know, at a time when we're dealing with massive inequality, we're going to talk about this in the second half of the show, but so many people are struggling under COVID. The food bank lines are long. I mean, we know all the problems, you know, people struggling to make ends meet. And I think about this question about objectivity, and it really does connect to what is the role of a journalist in today's time?
Well, you know, objectivity has always been a loaded term, and it never really has conveyed what the values of good journalism should be, because it suggests there is an objective world that anyone who's trained would see it exactly that way, sort of like adding up three numbers and coming up with the same answer for what an addition problem is. In the social world, isn't like that at all. Obviously, you and I could look at the same event, be trained journalists to be honest to a T, but see it differently because for a variety of reasons. And there might be value in both our positions, but they might come to lead to very different ideas about how to solve the problem. So I think what we seek in journalism instead is honesty, self-criticism, accuracy, factual accuracy, but put those things together. So that readers know where you're coming from, they understand it, but they also can trust that you've challenged your own assumptions and you've challenged your own facts to make sure they're accurate, that you've tested them out. That's what good journalism is, and that's not propaganda.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of propaganda, over the past couple of months, we've received so many emails from listeners who say, what can be done or what should be done about all of the lies that are spewed not only now by Fox, but Newsmax, OAN, and those outlets or whatever you want to call them, they are growing. So in size, what are your thoughts about that and how that should be dealt with?
Well, that's really an important question. So I'm glad your listeners share my concern about that. I mean, I think all of us are concerned about it. I think the solution is, ultimately, we just have to recreate journalism. Actually, there's a vacuum that those networks are filling and that their funders are gleefully making money off filling. And we have to come back with a genuine local journalism and a genuine national journalism that solves the needs that people have. And then this sort of sewage won't have the same currency. And some people will be attracted to it, but there will be a lot of people who will find other places to go to get their information and enter a world different than the one of pure propaganda and conspiracy theories and the like.
Yeah, and that's the thing, Robert. I've been hearing interviews with people who were in Q and are now out, and they said that that was really their only form of information.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty much true across the base of the sort of neo, this what I would call semi or neo-fascist right that is emerging, is they pretty much stick exclusively to their news information. And of course, liberals and even progressives, or also progressives, do the same. But I don't think it's quite identical. I think, again, it's the tenor of whether you're willing to challenge assumptions and vouch for your accuracy. And if you're proven inaccurate, you fess up, you examine why you got that way, you address it so it won't happen again.
Hmm. Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. I wanted to agree with Mr. McChesney about the NPR, the nature of NPR shows, and to point out that as a longtime supporter of KALW, I've been kind of distressed to see more and more of NPR coming in to replace, you know, what used to be regular shows, like your rebroadcast, for example, every night. That doesn't happen anymore. So that's what I had to say.
Well, thank you for that. And we'll send that message to our GM. You know, the other thing we've been wanting to do is bring on NPR's ombuds person to talk about these issues, because Charles just wrote in and said, I've written to the NPR ombudsman complaining about lack of coverage of the Trump administration's lies and horrible actions. The response, well, we get criticism from both sides, so we must be doing something right. And, you know, we used to actually have on the ombudsperson pretty regularly, Robert, and we haven't done that in a while. So I think we need to bring, I don't know the person's name, but we definitely need to bring them back.
Well, one thing I would also say is that whenever someone tells you we get shot at from both sides, so we must be doing something right, that just remind them that there's any medium in history has been shot at from both sides. That is no defense of what you do. You still have to actually defend what you do. You can't, that's a cop out. Right. I mean, the Nazis, believe it or not, the Nazi media had critics farther to the right that Hitler finally shut down who were critical of mainstream Nazi media. Does that mean that Nazi media is getting it right because they're getting shot at from both sides? Of course not. Oh. You've got to defend your actual content. You can't use that bogus line you're getting shot at from both sides.
Mm. Well, thank you for calling in, Judy. Let's go next to Bradley in San Francisco. Hi, Bradley. Welcome to the show.
Hello?
Hi, go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to ask about, you know, by the mid-19th century, a lot of the newspapers, a certain percentage, were sort of tied to the political parties directly, even with their name, like the Santa Rosa Democrat, you know, and this and that Republican. Mm-hmm. And so that there was a sort of party nature to our press as well. You know, and in 1912, when both sides bifurcated and you had the progressive Republicans and Republicans and the Democrats and the socialists, I mean, they all had their newspapers going on. So there was a really lively development in California and similarly around the country with Bill Moose stuff. But wasn't it like a party relation to papers that was established and then has sort of diminished over time? Or is that an incorrect view?
No, you actually know your history well. Throughout the 19th century, especially in the first half of the 19th century, political parties and newspapers were joined at the hip. In fact, in the first half of the 19th century, oftentimes editors of newspapers got jobs in the federal government or the governor's state government when their party was in power. They were clearly a part of the party system. They were seen as I said earlier, for the social movements in the period, likewise, they were seen as the outreach to the public to organize your voters was through the newspaper, through your journalism. That began to change with the commercialization of news, with the rise of advertising. And when newspapers became a source of great profits, then the most important thing wasn't winning the next election. It was making as much money as possible. And you didn't want to antagonize potential customers who might not be in your party. But newspapers kept the party affiliation through the 20th century. Most newspapers had a pretty clear affiliation, but they claimed it was only shown on their editorial page, not in their news coverage.
Right.
Well, thank you for calling, Bradley. There is a great podcast that goes over the history of journalism. It is fascinating. It's called The View from Somewhere, Undoing the Myth of Journalistic Objectivity. And we've been wanting to have Lewis Raven Wallace on the show because he also wrote a book about this. It's really fascinating information. So thank you for that call. We're going to take one more call. Let's go to Phil in New Mexico. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for taking my call. Robert, I'm an alum of UIUC, so I'm always delighted to hear one of its faculty. I love your work and the work you do with John Nichols. My question specifically has to do with this new tax out of Australia that they're putting on Google, and I don't know about Facebook, to try to generate revenue. I wonder what you think about it, and can we get something like that going in the United States and hopefully elsewhere?
Well, you know, this is a really important question, not just in Australia and here, but across the world. Europe is considering this, Canada as well. Everyone says that advertising money has left conventional journalism and gone to basically Google and Facebook and a few other giants on the internet. Why don't we tax them and take that money to go back and pay for journalism again? And I'm not a fan of that. I don't approve necessarily of that as a way to go. I understand its appeal. I think that we need to support journalism with public funds. But I think like education or national defense, you shouldn't have to say, and here we're going to find someone else to pay for it. You don't have to worry about it, taxpayers. Those guys are the bad guys. They'll pay for it. Because then basically you're starting a fight with Google and Facebook when you should have a fight over, well, how, do we need journalists or not? That should be the core issue. Now, having said that, I think that these internet monopolies, Google, Facebook, Amazon, they all need to be dealt with directly. It's one of the great political issues of our times. And one of the reasons we need journalism is so we can have a debate over how best to deal with these internet platform monopolies of these companies. So I'm in favor of public funding. I'm not in favor of linking it specifically to getting those guys to pay for it, but I'm very much in favor of going after those guys with separate policies from the journalism policies.
And just quickly, Robert, one of the solutions that you put forward would be to establish a budget of $100 per person to support local nonprofit journalism, and then people can vote to decide which media outlet gets that money.
Exactly. That's the plan that a bunch of us have been working on. I wish I could report to you that when we broach the subject with politicians, they drop everything and say that's the greatest thing since sliced bread. We haven't reached that stage yet, unfortunately.
Well, we'd love to have you back to continue this conversation. Robert McChesney is professor of communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and the author of many books. You can find out more about his work at yourcallradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us, Robert, and thanks for your great work.
Oh, thank you very much. My pleasure.
Thank you. We just got an interesting tweet from Adrian who said, just found out that my father-in-law, who recently moved here from out of state, is not watching local news at all. I will send him a reminder tonight to tune in. Perhaps we can affect some change with little moves like this. Well, yeah, that's how it's done, Adrian. And please send us a follow-up when you have a conversation with your father-in-law. We'd love to hear from you. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will talk about the Democrats' $1.9 trillion relief package and media coverage. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Now we are going to talk about President Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID relief plan, which includes $1,400 stimulus checks, unemployment support, $15 minimum wage, and more. Very early this morning, Vice President Kamala Harris broke a 50-50 tie by casting a vote in favor of the package, which sends it to the House for approval. Joining us to talk about coverage and the latest developments are two guests. Arthur Delaney is a reporter for the Huffington Post, where he covers politics and the economy, and he has been covering this issue. Hi, Arthur. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, author of many books, including his most recent, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. David is founder and editor-in-chief of DC Report, a nonprofit news organization that reports on what government officials do, not what they say. Hi, David. Thank you for joining us again.
Well, I'm glad to be with you again.
Well, it's great to have you, David. I want to start off with you. You wrote a piece for DC Report called Even Biden's $1.9 trillion package is not nearly enough. Before we dive in and talk about the details, David, This has received so much media coverage. So much of the coverage is focused on the politics and not what's actually in the bill. What are your thoughts about the coverage?
Well, the biggest thing coverage has not dealt with adequately is that the House passed the floor of this measure last spring. It's been months now, and it was Mitch McConnell, who was a majority leader, now he's minority leader, but majority leader in the Senate, who simply would not move on this.
David, we're having a hard time hearing you. Can you maybe speak closer to your computer?
Let me switch.
Maybe you were on headphones.
Maybe you can hear me better now.
Oh, so much better. Thank you.
Okay. Took off my AirPods.
Perfect.
Back in, I think it was May, but last spring, the House passed another coronavirus relief measure. And it went nowhere because Mitch McConnell, as majority leader in the Senate, wouldn't allow it to go anywhere. And there's been a great deal of damage from that. People who are way behind on the rent, landlords who are behind on their mortgages because they haven't gotten rent, and many other problems. And I think it's important to give context to the passage of this bill that it's been held up for forever.
Yes.
People who are without work through no fault of their own, and I would argue through the mismanagement of the pandemic, which I predicted in 2017 would happen if we had one, that Donald Trump would totally mismanage it and have no idea what to do. And that's, of course, what we saw.
This is such a good point. Arthur, can you also give us a little bit of context before we talk about where we are and what's in the bill?
Well, the main context is that there's still a virus going around that makes it impossible for the economy to function at its fullest capacity. And that means basically that people's lives are worse because they have less money. And so an important part of the bill is to help speed up vaccine distribution, which would definitely help. I'm less expert on that, but I know more about the economic parts of this. And the stuff that Congress has passed already is significant. And what the Democrats are trying to do is to not lose the momentum of that spending, to pass another bill before the last one runs out. And they've pegged it to the expiring unemployment benefits, the extra federal unemployment benefits that run out in March. They're saying, let's get the next bill done before then, not only so that unemployed people don't have a gap, but so that we keep the pedal to the metal in terms of what the government can do to help the economy. Because, with the virus slowing things down, the government's ability to help may actually be kind of limited. But they're doing what's so different now is that they're saying, let's just keep throwing money at it. They would never have done this 10 years ago. And I think it's probably a really good situation ultimately in terms of fiscal policy, doing the most good it possibly can when it's needed the most.
What do you both think about the media covering the issue of the struggle that we're seeing across the country? I'm just doing a news search for food and struggle. There's just so many, it looks like local outlets. Survey shows food security in Montana. Four moms in Colorado are raising money to give families diapers. There's, what's called these free grocery stores now popping up around the country because people are in such dire need. David, what are your thoughts about how the media are covering that important angle?
I actually think there's been pretty good coverage of food insecurity and the pressure that's on food banks, which started in the Bay Area in the 1970s as a temporary measure, and they're still with us almost a half century later. The need, however, for money for other expenses like utilities, especially in the winter when you have to have heat, paying the rent, that's gotten a lot less coverage. And I think part of the reason for that is if you look at where the coronavirus has done damage, it's heavily been in poorer neighborhoods where people of color tend to live, but there are lots of also white people in them who are densely packed and tend to work in those fields that we call essential services, where they've got to go to work whether it's stocking grocery shelves or, delivering things. And so I think that it has led a lot of people to believe wrongly that this is not really a problem because they don't see it because of our economic and racial segregation in America.
Hmm. Arthur, you and a few colleagues wrote a piece called Congress Could Finally Make Life Better for Parents If It Doesn't Blow It. And you focus on Tammy Birch, a 40-year-old single mom in Kansas who was just getting by before COVID hit. She has 10-year-old twins, was working 40 hours a week overseeing the kitchen in an assisted living facility. She got paid about 10 bucks an hour. She said she really liked the work. And she had a really hard life before the pandemic, trying to make ends meet. Tell us about her and how the relief package would help people in similar situations.
That story is about how, for parents, the federal government doesn't help as much as it could, as much as other countries help parents there. There's the patchwork of like tax credits and in-kind benefit programs for food or health care. But if you don't have money or you don't have childcare, you're sort of screwed. Mm-hmm. And that's just the status quo we've had in this country for decades. The pandemic definitely magnified it in a big way. And because of the way politics is changing, for the first time in decades, there's a real discussion about just fundamentally changing that situation. And what's on the table, what's on the table is a new monthly child benefit for almost all parents. And the reason we put If Congress Doesn't Blow It as our headline is that we're not sure how committed Democrats even are to following through and just giving parents money, which has been like the thing Congress has resisted doing forever, but is now they're actually talking about doing it. So it's a real moment, and it could happen in the pandemic relief bill. The $1.9 trillion bill has the seeds of this new program. And so it's a huge moment in politics. And you have Mitt Romney yesterday coming out with a child benefit proposal of his own. So there's bipartisan energy there. And are we going to change the way the federal government takes care of families, or will the status quo prevail? Big moment.
David, what would you add to that?
Well, first of all, Arthur and the two other reporters you wrote with are exactly right about the patchwork nature of this. This is part of what I call the make work economy. Congress keeps passing this little program and that program and this medium-sized one that don't line up, but create a lot of work, paid and unpaid, for paperwork and allow people to fall through the cracks when we could have a simplified system. Many advanced economies, particularly in Europe, see to it that the parents of newborns must stay home to be with them, at least for their first 6 months or a year. And there's very good research from the University of Chicago showing that every dollar we invest in the welfare of children from conception through the first, I think it's 18 months or 3 years, pays off with a lifetime compound increase in value of 7%. If you're a young person and you can find a 7% guaranteed investment for the rest of your life, go buy it. You will be great, well off when you're older. And we need to stop treating children as the one minority we can abuse with abandon. The system that we have set up that does not provide children with enough care, that has forced many households to have both parents work and sometimes both parents work more than one job, is not free. It costs us terribly in the upbringing of children and the quality of their life, social, psychological, and economic, as adults.
And David, I mean, it seems like, well, for this issue, childcare, for example, you need a bill in D.C. And we did a show last week about Through the Night. It's a new documentary that looks at the U.S. childcare crisis. And in 1971, the United States came so close to ensuring universal child care. The bill would have created a national network of federally funded child care centers. The cost would have been subsidized. It passed. Republicans and Democrats supported the bill, but Nixon vetoed it after Pat Buchanan basically got to him and said, you know, we can't allow government intrusion in the family, and it's never come up again. Elizabeth Warren talks about it. Bernie Sanders talks about it. And so given the political state today, how do you get to the point where we could pass a universal child care bill, which is so desperately needed?
Well, first of all, let's not listen on child care to people like Pat Buchanan who have no children. Just for starters. I think there is a growing awareness, especially as you go down the age ladder, that what we have been doing for the last 40 years isn't working.
Right.
We have followed a policy since Reagan of supply side economics, which has turned out to be unbelievably successful in creating wealth at the top. What we need now is a society focused on demand side economics and on simplifying people's lives. There is no reason, for example, that people who go on Medicare have to make all these complex choices about supplemental insurance. Let's just have Medicare take care of your bills without any need for supplemental programs. We can do that by changing the rules. When it comes to children, let's get rid of all these different programs, including the tax code's 5 different definitions of children, and come up with a unified solution. Simplicity is the friend of a prosperous and healthy and stable economy. Complexity is the friend of cheats, of exploiters, and of people who are rentiers, that is, they're going to make money without working.
Arthur, what would you add to that? You cover these issues.
I don't want to oversell it. I don't want to overhype, but there's momentous stuff potentially happening in Congress. So Democrats have a proposal to take the child tax credit, which is very boring and obscure and complicated, but change it into something that instead of you get a, you know, based on a sliding scale of income eligibility after you file a tax return, you receive a cash payment representing a portion of the refundability. You know, they'll just say, listen, everyone gets $300 a month from this policy. They still want to call it the child a tax credit because they're afraid if they say it's big government that everyone will hate it. But that's actually on the table right now. And that would change everything. That would slash child poverty. That would give parents money every month that they could count on instead of like a lump sum that they have to fetch from Liberty Tax. It's a potentially revolutionary idea, and there's hesitancy among Democrats. Mitt Romney came out with this thing yesterday that's actually simpler. It's just let the Social Security Administration pay families every month. And Democrats could say, hey, look, a Republican said, let's do that. Let's do it. They could take that and run with it, but we're waiting to see. And I know it feels like too much hype, but that is seriously on the table right now. And it never has been before. There hasn't been a proposal to just give parents money since I think the Nixon era, when even Nixon himself at one point supported a family assistance plan. And they were like, nah, let's do tax credits instead. The tax credits, people don't even know where they come from. They're hard to get. They put you at the mercy of a tax prep company. But they're talking about getting the middleman out of the way, and it's honestly a question of whether they actually do it. And they're all this talk about going big right now is encouraging for anyone who wants to see this happen.
Right, and to your point, Bill just emailed us. Not all Democrats support Biden's COVID bill, so it's not a slam dunk.
Well, it looks like they do. Honestly, everyone's looking at like Joe Manchin because he. He didn't like the minimum wage part of it, for example. But that part's probably got to get taken out anyway, because they have they're doing this with the budget process where all the measures, according to the rule, have to like raise revenue or spend money, and the minimum wage directly doesn't do either of those things. So that might just, for bureaucratic reasons, go away. But Joe Manchin has this sort of pivot, this choke point, this fulcrum. Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, who's a Democrat but hesitates to seem really liberal, he's voted for the budget resolution that will undergird the eventual passage of the bill. He said he wants Joe Biden to be successful. He said if it's $1.9 trillion, so be it. So I think there is actually some Democratic unity here, and it's more a question of whether any Republicans will go along with it.
So let's talk about what's actually in the bill, because it's been framed through the lens of politics. And David, you wrote about this. Let's talk about what's actually in it. It would increase the federal per week unemployment benefit to $400 and extend it through the end of September. And this is something that's been desperately needed over the past year.
Yes. And the reason that there's pressure to do it at $400 rather than $600 is $600 a week is the equivalent of $15 an hour. And it weakens the argument against raising the minimum wage. The provision that's in there now would raise the minimum wage to $15 by 2025. So it's not immediate if it were to take effect. But I agree with Arthur. It's probably going to come out of the bill before it's passed. I argue in my column that the $400 should be open-ended until we declare that this is over, because with the mutations that we're seeing in this virus, we may end up with an endemic situation that severely limits people's ability to move around, may radically change the way we have lived up until now, partly because we have 8 billion people and jetliners that allow viruses to hopscotch quickly all over the planet. Mm.
There's also $350 billion in state and local government aid. This is what the Republicans were just opposing from the majority of the last year. And David, this would actually ensure that government workers do not lose their jobs.
Yeah, if the Democrats are smart about this, they will start saying, okay, so the Republicans want to lay off police. They want to defund the police. They want to lay off firefighters. They say they want you to go back to school, but they want teachers to be laid off. I mean, Arthur was making what I think is a very good point. The Democrats have both chambers of Congress and the White House. They should not hold back. They should say, this is where we want to go. They should press hard and press fast and do it in ways that people will see that in their pocketbook. Because one thing we've known since VOT's research in the late 1950s is that Americans tend to vote their pocketbook. Here is your chance to show we can have a better economy and work on improving the demand side by getting more people work and higher wages. And let's not forget that of the 10 million people that have been thrown out of work for by this pandemic currently, 4 million of them haven't had a paycheck for 6 months.
Mm. Wow. And then in the bill, there's also $50 billion toward COVID testing, $20 billion toward a national vaccine program in partnership with states, localities, and tribes. And Arthur, this one's really important for obvious reasons. In many parts of the country, in California, the rollout has been very rocky. There are so many unanswered questions. And NPR did some great reporting this morning about how in many cities across the country, people of color are not getting vaccinated. It's the centers are in places where mostly white people live.
Oh, it's horrible. And if you don't get the virus under control, all this other economic stuff could become irrelevant because while people wait around for shots, they can't go to work. They literally can't. Like all kinds of jobs just do not work when there's a threat of a weird virus that makes you gasp for air and scrambles your blood and has unknown long-term consequences. Like so many industries that involve people in a room cannot function. And so it's a shame that Donald Trump made like the simplest preventive measures into like a huge political statement, like wearing a mask. Like we can't have that. So now we're all counting on the shot. If the shot doesn't get around fast enough, all the money that they spend helping the economy cannot help the economy because people have to stay home. So it's like the first thing, the most important thing that has to get done. And hopefully they will. I mean, I'm not the expert on scaling up vaccine distribution, but as far as I know, it's something that's totally plausible for them to try to do.
Right. Another one, $170 billion for K-12 schools and institutions of higher education. We'll be talking about this in the coming weeks, but the city of San Francisco has sued its own school district to reopen classes. We're almost out of time. David, final thoughts. Now that Vice President Kamala Harris broke a 50-50 tie by casting a vote in favor of the package early this morning, what's next?
Hopefully it's the Democrats acting boldly, getting an infrastructure bill, something Trump, if he'd been smart, would have done right away, and getting people back to work, rebuilding the economy, rebuilding it better. That should be their focus, and they should use the majority while they've got it if they want to keep their majority.
Arthur, final thoughts on what's next?
I just think the whole situation is incredibly important. Either we're going to have a government that's responsive to the needs of people, or people will lose faith in democracy and we'll have more horrible stuff like the insurrection at the Capitol. I think there's a clear warning that it has to look like the government can meet the moment.
Arthur Delaney is a reporter for the Huffington Post covering politics and the economy. Be sure to check out the piece he wrote with two colleagues. Congress could finally make life better for parents if it doesn't blow it. Arthur, thanks so much for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and author of many books. He is founder and editor-in-chief of DC Report, and you can find his latest columns, including Even Biden's $1.9 trillion plan is not nearly enough pandemic relief, at yourcallradio.org. David, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. And you can find other stories there about the issues that we talked about. You can also listen to our past shows and sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Joanne Marr and Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running and engineering the show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls Media Roundtable.